Henry V's Agincourt Campaign, Part 1, by Blown Periphery. On a wet and dank evening of the 24th of October 1415, a small English army of some 812 men at arms and 3,073 foot and mounted archers tried to find what shelter they could and waited for battle the following day. The English army was sick and exhausted after a long campaign, which included the protracted siege of Harfleur in Normandy. King Henry V had fought the campaign to recover what he believed to be rightly his, the Duchy of Normandy. Henry's army was trying to reach the relative safety of Calais, but standing to block them was the French army of 8,400 mounted men at arms, 14,000 footmen at arms and 2,000 crossbowmen and archers. The French were confident that their army that outnumbered the English 6-to-1 would annihilate Henry's small force. The two armies were drawn up close to the small, provincial castle of Agincourt. The French army astride the road to Calais and the English salvation. The following day, a dysentery-ridden English army, outnumbered and short of supplies, comprehensively defeated and humiliated a vastly superior in size French army. It was a miracle, a divine intervention. It became one of the most famous examples of the English fighting against all the odds and defeating a vastly superior enemy force. The hell it was! French incompetence and hubris, the tactical genius of Henry V, the discipline and resolution of the English troops and the forgotten essentials of national pride and the willingness to endure, made the French defeat inevitable. The English didn't win the Battle of Agincourt. The French lost it. Henry V, King of England. A 12-year-old Henry was knighted by Richard II in 1399, whilst participating in Richard's campaign in Ireland. He was accompanying Richard as a hostage for his exiled father's good behaviour. His father, Henry Bolingbroke, knighted him again on the eve of his coronation as Henry IV, after having deposed Richard II. The boy who would be king first saw military service against Scotland in 1400. Later as Prince of Wales he would be in action against Owen Glendr, who also laid claim to the title. Henry was in nominal command of the powerful Marcher Lords who really wielded the power, fighting a guerrilla war against the elusive Welsh. This would provide valuable experience of the grim realities and hardships of military campaigning. Henry was tutored in his art of war by the Percy family, whom Henry would face in battle a year later, when the Percys wanted more control and recognition in their helping Henry IV to the throne. They made an alliance with Owen Glendr and attempted to join him in 1403. Henry VI, with his son, made a forced march and intercepted the rebels at the Battle of Shrewsbury on the 21st July. It was a hard-fought and bloody battle, young Henry leading the king's left wing. The royalists were forced to advance uphill, against a hail of archery from the best Cheshire bowmen in the country. Henry was wounded and disfigured by an arrow that hit his face. He fought on until the battle was won, showing determination despite the pain of his wound. The lesson of the effectiveness of the long bow wasn't lost on Henry. Henry became king when his father died in 1413. He had fought two major battles, had been wounded in action, commanded men in formal battle, endured the discomfort and tedium of campaigning, but above all, he understood the vital importance of attention to detail and meticulous planning required in all matters military. Henry V was a pious man and believed in the sanctity of the church and its property. He was a strict disciplinarian who enforced rigid campaign discipline. To the French he was arrogant, ruthless and cruel. He oversaw a massacre after the taking of Rouen in 1417 and refused food for the women and children expelled from Rouen and trapped between the closed city and the siege lines. He massacred the prisoners at Agincourt, a justifiable act according to the then laws of warfare, but an horrific act nonetheless. Warfare from an early age had brutalized Henry. He was a soldier king of his time. An effective and ruthless leader. The French leadership. The English were blessed to have such a ruthlessly efficient leader, while the French in contrast were in turmoil. King Charles VI was periodically insane, and although unquestionably brave during periods of sanity, he was in no position to lead the French. His son the Dauphin was an effete, unmilitary youngster of 19. The weak state of the French leadership had almost led to civil war, in which the Burgundian and Armagnac factions had vied for supremacy. Clear and unified leadership was impossible. The king and his advisers didn't want to call upon John Duke of Burgundy, nor Charles Duke of Orleans, because they were incapable of working together. There were effective leaders on the French side who had won their spurs in earlier internecine wars or crusades, such as Charles d'Albret, who was an experienced and cautious warrior, who had held the post of constable since 1402. John Lamanga, known as Boucicault, had a warrior's reputation and was a stalwart crusader, who had defended Constantinople against the Ottomans in 1399. These measured and cautious fighters could have given the English a run for their money and worn the English down by attrition. However, at Agincourt, they were overruled by the arrogant young dukes, the princes of the blood. D'Albret and Boucicault had run the campaign efficiently up to the eve of battle, but for the battle itself, nobody on the French side was in overall command. The armies and their equipment. Armies of the 15th century were based on the men-at-arms, which is a man in a composite suit of armor, trained to fight on horseback and on foot. If he possessed the social standing, he would be a knight, but most were not. They were esquires, the rank below a knight, or ordinary soldiers who possessed some wealth, which was needed to purchase the equipment and horses to move them. While men-at-arms were cavalrymen due to training and ethos, most battles were fought on foot. He would lead a lancer group of retainers who had enough wealth to afford horses and the equipment. There were light cavalry known as hobilers, but they played no part in the Agincourt campaign. Until the mid-13th century, armor had been primarily chain mail, augmented by steel plates to protect vulnerable parts of the body. By the 15th century, the suit of armor had reached its maturity and men-at-arms were equipped cap-à-pie in armor. A padded jerkin known as an aiken was worn under the armor to prevent chafing and give added ballistic protection from blows and arrow strikes. The armor plate could be polished to reflect the heat of the sun and prevent heat exhaustion. It required a squire to help the man-at-arms into his 60 to 80 pounds of aiken and armor, but it was fully articulated and he could easily mount his horse without a crane and get up from the ground unless unconscious or stunned. Some specialist modern infantry go into battle carrying far bulkier and heavier equipment. The heaviest and most cumbersome piece of equipment was the helmet with its solid neck guard called a gorget. The face was protected by a visor or bassinet, the pointed version known as a dog-faced bassinet, which could be hinged or slid open for better visibility or ventilation. Henry V wore a bucket-like great helmet Agincourt, a heavy and uncomfortable helmet, but it probably saved his life. Shields were becoming less used by Agincourt, and richer knights wore their coat of arms embossed on their armor or a close-fitting garment called a coat d'armes. This was a valuable insurance policy and denoted that the wearer was worthy of ransom, as opposed to the inevitable slaughter the archers could expect. The man-at-arms could wield a lance or a sword. The lance was 12 feet long, made from ash. If fighting on foot, it was shortened or a poleaxe was favored, a double-headed axe and spear point mounted and braced on a 6-foot pole. The poleaxe could bludgeon, cleave or impale an opponent and was useful for disabling horses by cutting their leg tendons. But the queen of the battlefield was still the sword. Made of the finest steel, such as that from Bordeaux, 3 feet long, double-edged with a cross guard and heavy pommel. Some were longer and had to be swung with both hands in a circulatory motion. Even a glancing blow could stun or incapacitate an opponent. Finally, the man-at-arms carried a dagger or ballock on his hip. It was not a primary combat weapon, but useful for dispatching the wounded or slipping through the visor of an incapacitated enemy. It goes without saying that men-at-arms had to be incredibly tough, resilient and robust individuals, the cream of their society. White or polished armor from the 15th century. The English archers generally used the bodkin arrowhead against armored targets. A bodkin point is a type of arrowhead. In its simplest form, it is an uncomplicated squared metal spike, and was used extensively during the Middle Ages. The typical bodkin was a square section arrowhead, generally up to 4.5 in long and 0.39 in thick at its widest point, tapered down behind this initial punch shape. Bodkin arrows complemented traditional broadhead arrows, which continued to be used, as the sharp, wide-cutting surface of the broadhead caused more serious wounds and tissue damage than the bodkin. The name comes from the Old English word bodkin or bodekin, a type of sharp, pointed dagger. Arrows of the long bodkin type were used by the Vikings and continued to be used throughout the Middle Ages. The bodkin point eventually fell out of use during the 16th and 17th centuries, as armor largely ceased to be worn. The archers were also armed with axes to prepare defensive palisades and short swords for melee fighting. A dagger was also carried for dispatching the wounded and those unworthy of ransom. An archer's equipment. Note the bowl, mug and racing spoon, still in use today. The French preferred to employ professional, mercenary crossbowmen rather than archers. They were mainly used in sieges, wore some armor and fought from behind a large shield when reloading. Their bassinets were hinged on the right-hand side to enable the crossbow to be aimed. The heavy war crossbow was about 3 feet in length and the bow was a composite of laminated wood, bone and sinew. Crossbow quarrels or bolts were heavy, about 18 inches long and fletched with wood or leather. About 12 quarrels were carried and they could outrange the longbow with a flatter trajectory. At short range they were devastating. The main drawbacks were the slow rate of fire of 2 to 3 round per minute and the requirement of a mechanical spanner to reload the heavy crossbow. Heavier crossbowmen needed a second person to carry and set up the defensive shield, and it is extremely unlikely that any opposition would sit back calmly and watch the crossbow teams get set up, without attempting to ruin their day. The English also used engineers and gunners during the Siege of Harfleur. These men were truly professional and had a European-wide reputation in the use and transportation of the heavy siege guns. Hand gunners were starting to appear on the battlefield, although their use was still limited at the time of Agincourt. Gunners wore armor, mainly as protection from their own weapons. Many a gunner was hoisted by his own petard when his gun exploded, and loss of fingers and eyes were common. Part 2 will discuss Henry V's claims in France, the organization of the armies and the Siege of Harfleur. Copyright Blown Periphery 2018.